we suggest we read it again?
Yeah, I'm suggesting we read it again because the last paragraph we dealt with was very dense. And to understand it properly, we need to look at this paragraph, second last paragraph we dealt with once again. It's a very important, these two paragraphs are key paragraphs, this entire chapter. So, maybe we can visit these two paragraphs once again, start from there.
New edition, it's 957.
Because on that point, right, that he's developing the idea, but he's developing the idea of movement from the first to the second and third transformations. Since he has left those undeveloped in the previous chapter, particularly he's concerned with the ascent towards supermind and the problems concerned with that, since in some way it is so alien to our present consciousness. So he starts off by saying that there are some elements in our present which are derived. One may say the whole of our higher existence is derived from supermind. And so we may be able to intuit certain aspects of its operation, extrapolate certain aspects of its operation. But having said that, he proceeds to talk about what it implies on our condition in an evolutionary sense towards supermind. What does it mean for individual and what reality? So I think from that paragraph, transition to supermind. If we can start, it would be nice. So whoever would like to read.
Louis, would you like to read?
How does this microphone sound? Does it sound okay?
Yes, sounds okay.
Okay, it's different. The transition to supermind through overmind is a passage from nature as we know it into supernature. It is by that very fact impossible for any effort of the mere mind to achieve our unaided expression and object. Belongs to the inferior power of the ignorance cannot achieve by its own strength or characteristic or available methods with its own domain of nature. All the previous ascensions have been effectuated by a secret consciousness force operating first in inconscience and then in the ignorance. It has worked by an emergence of its involved powers to the surface, powers concealed behind the veil and superior to the past formulations of nature. But even so, there is needed a pressure of the same superior powers already formulated in their full natural force on their own planes. These superior planes create their own foundation in our subliminal parts, and from there are able to influence the evolutionary process on the surface. Overmind and supermind are also involved and occult in earth nature, but they have no formations on the accessible levels of our subliminal inner consciousness. There is yet no overmind being or organized overmind nature, no supermental being or organized supermind nature acting either on our surface or in our normal subliminal parts. But these greater powers of consciousness are superconscient to the level of our ignorance. In order that the involved principles of overmind and supermind should emerge from their veiled secrecy, the being and powers of the superconscience must descend into us and uplift us and formulate themselves in our being and powers. This descent is in a sine qua non of the transition and transformation.
Oh, that's the word you're asking me.
So this paragraph, I think, needs a little closer attention because it's such a key paragraph, key transition to what he has to say regarding the ascent to supermind. First and foremost, as he points out, that this transgression is a movement into another kind of nature, what he calls supernature. Therefore, not something that is established in any recognizable sense in our nature world, in our own inner nature as well as in the cosmic nature. So the point that he's making from there is a very key one. And it relates, in fact, to what we discussed last time as the notion of Superman, that has in some sense occupied the intuition of modernity ever since the turn of the 19th, 20th century. See, from late 19th century, there has been a sense that mind has reached the end of its tether, but also there has been a growing sense of the creative will of the human as being something that can force a rupture, that in some way has an advantage over nature that it needs to leverage to overcome these difficulties. So the thinking of the overman, as we discussed last time, makes its beginning in modern philosophy with Nietzsche, who talks about this power of human creativity to overcome the laws of nature. Man is a rope between the animal and the Superman and the God. So it is this ability to mobilize something from within to transition to a state of perfection that we intuit and that we are dissatisfied about not reaching, that sort of in a sense initiates the project of our contemporary world. Underlying it is this aspiration. Now, the key idea in this particular paragraph that Sri Aurobindo introduces and interposes into this intuition of modern world is that ignorance... just a moment. I think Keka has got knocked off. She was trying to join, so... maybe she needs to be put back. So, what Sri Aurobindo is introducing into this aspiration of the modern age is the idea that from the ignorance, no perfection can come. This is a very key notion, and it's a very, very powerful idea that he's introducing in this particular paragraph. And he's introducing it in an evolutionary sense. Along with it comes a theory of evolution, of the process of evolution. Not of evolution per se, but of its process. In that, if we are to conceive of something imperfect, it can only make approximations towards perfection. It cannot build perfection unless it already knows perfection. Whatever we achieve is first intuited by us. And this kind of intuition comes because there is a already existent reality that we receive in our inner or subliminal planes. And with our aspiration, we make approximations towards it, but due to the pressure of that already existing perfection, we give it shape. See, finally it comes into existence. This is phenomenology, in a sense, which we all recognize. I mean, if we probe our own experience, we find that this is how things work. Sri Aurobindo is translating that to the cosmic level in terms of cosmic evolution. And he's saying the way evolution occurs is that there is the latency or immanence or involvement of secret powers that are asleep in nature that arise first in the inconscient. That's a very powerful part as well of this paragraph, where he talks about the two phases of arising. As he says over here, all the previous ascensions have been effectuated by a secret consciousness force operating first in inconscience and then in the ignorance. See, these two levels are very important to understand, because inconscience is like the objectivization of Satchidananda. It is a dark infinite. It has got the entirety of infinite consciousness latent in it, but hidden from operation. And so, first there must be the stirring in the inconscience, which allows at all any kind of intimation of hidden possibility to emerge. Then this emerges into the ignorance. Its emergence or the possibility of knowledge, ignorance is the possibility of knowledge, makes it something which enters into consciousness, cosmic consciousness, as an aspiration. So this aspiration then meets or pulls into its own orbit already existing consciousness of its own perfection as a kind of luminous pressure from above. The luminous pressure is only felt as a pressure. It does not enter into the ignorance. It is felt as a pressure. The aspiration tending towards that particular kind of downward leaning pressure experiences approximations of manifestation. And it is only at a certain pitch that the image of perfection is formed within the subliminal and then can manifest in some form on the surface. Usually at such a point, there is a descent, the new. However, between whatever has been achieved so far and what is to come, in other words, between the powers of ignorance which have manifested successively in the terrestrial nature and the power of supermind, there is a big gulf. That gulf arises because whether we talk about manifestations of life or manifestations of mind, these are latencies within the ignorance. They are powers of ignorance. They are powers circumscribed by mind. Mind in its emergence makes these powers appear. And so subliminally one may say it is much easier for their fulfilled expression to be received by the ignorance. This is where again the distinction between nature and supernature comes into play. For the modality of perfection that belongs to supermind to have some kind of universal, such more is needed because it does not belong to the ignorance. Cosmic ignorance is already circumscribed by the lack of knowledge of supermind. Even if supramental aspiration arises in the inconscient, it cannot really achieve approximations towards any degree of fulfillment. Film structures that have been built, they are not yet built. This is the point that he's making over here. Now, on the other hand, the fact is that individually, we may go beyond cosmic nature. And in the individual case, emergence of the psychic being the first transformation, the psychic transformation, activates this aspiration towards overmind and supermind in a more significant way than it does in the cosmic nature and in the subliminal universal. That emergence can actually effect a reversal of consciousness. That reversal of consciousness can ultimately be instrumental in a descent of that higher power. Now, this is exactly where the project of the Life Divine is pushing towards the reversal of consciousness that opens up something new. That at some point we have to move from nature's yoga to the yoga of the Purusha. Yoga of the Purusha itself has to transcend its limitations and ignorance and effect a descent of something of a higher nature, that is of super nature or of super mind. Now, that also is almost impossible to achieve by the human individual. Were it not for the power of supermind itself to help in the effectuation of this transition, this is why the integral yoga depends so strongly on the power of descent. It is only by opening to the Shakti of supermind that this particular transition becomes possible. Now, Shakti of supermind is also not something so easily present within the ignorance. It's also historically active at a certain point. This is why Sri Aurobindo is making the evolutionary case here, and he's leaving the historicity sort of underplayed in this particular track, because that's the nature of this book, The Life Divine. In The Life Divine, he is pointing to our present state, particularly in these chapters, but not making any predictions, not making any apocalyptic statements about whether there is going to be an intervention or not. However, the point he's making over here is that Shakti of supermind must be active, must become, in a sense, the initiating force, without which neither cosmic nature nor the psychic being of the individual can fully achieve this transition that he's talking about. This is a very important point that he's making over here. Overmind and supermind are not established in their links in the occult planes. However, that there must be reliance in order that the evolved principles of overmind and supermind should emerge from their real secrecy. The beings and powers of superconscience must descend into us and uplift us, formulate themselves in our being and powers. This descent is a sine qua non of the transition and transformation. So this descent the power of overmind and supermind is something that one may say, in some sense, this whole work, The Life Divine, and much of Sri Aurobindo's work is premised on a certain historical rupture, where he's pointing to the fact that not only the power of creativity or even the psychic being, but something new operating, leaning down from above, pressing and in some sense entering into the terrestrial nature is happening now, is the phenomenon of the contemporary earth. So in a sense, that is where we come to certain very important phases. Is it about in The Life Divine at all? One is the notion of the avatar. That is, for such a descent to take place, this transition at a specific time in history has to be accompanied by a certain change of consciousness. a pressure above that becomes activated and embodied. That embodiment that allows that rupture to take place has two elements to it. One is a certain kind of greater power, almost a divine power of ascension, orders and cause the descent to take place. And a second is the willingness of the descending force itself. Now, when Sri Aurobindo was writing this, it's unclear to what extent he was aware of these embodiments, but it is clear that he had already seen his own mission as being that of pushing those borders and causing that descent to take place. This had happened to him already during the Alipur jail period, in which he saw this as the rest of his yogic work. And also, by this time, the mother had entered into the consciousness of the ashram or of Sri Aurobindo. And the idea that this force has also embodied itself, the Shakti has embodied itself, in some way to make that transition possible, though veiled, the mother herself is not at this point aware fully of the fact that this is her mission. But it is evident and clear that there is a certain power of descent and of manifestation that she carries that makes this transition possible. So this is one very key element of the idea of the descending force of supermind in our times that is understated in the life divine. What he's pointing out here is that whether these embodiments are acknowledged or not, whether they exist or not, there is a descending force at this time. If there is no descending force at this time, then this power is impossible, this transition is impossible. Impossible for cosmic nature and for individual nature. This is the point that he's making after his considered exploration of consciousness and his understanding of evolution.
Oh, Devashish?
Yes, Vince.
Well, I just want to say thank you for clearing that up, for explaining that. That's a wonderful paragraph. It just explains so much in it, doesn't it, about the ascent and the avatar and the one.
You're quite right. And also, a lot is understated. And you could take it even further and say the processes we discussed last time. About the question was raised that if the overmind descended in 1926 and if the supermind descended in 1956, then is it still the same in terms of the occult action in the subliminal planes? And one may say that, yes, something has perhaps changed, but that's also part of what he's talking about. The descending force was actually experienced by Sri Aurobindo even before that. The Shakti had become active, but had not fully entered, and he realized the fact that that was his yogic work. Now, in later times, and that's partly the reason why he constantly, underplayed this whole idea of the avatar. But one realizes that in this transition, in this evolutionary transition, there are secret processes involved. It is not merely a consciousness, but it allows that consciousness to descend. And in this particular case, as he'll point out later, it is not just the ascent of the Purusha that is necessary, but the much more difficult ascent of the Prakriti that is necessary. For that, it is necessary for that higher Shakti to embody itself. Or at least for the higher Shakti, I mean, if the higher Shakti embodies itself, the transition becomes much more possible. It is almost a sine qua non, as he says. This is what gives rise to this, you know, very rare combination at this time of the need for embodiment in both the Purusha and the Shakti. Now, the other part of it is that surrender to the Shakti is also a sine qua non. And that is something that he's going to draw out in the next paragraph. And that is man's responsibility, the human side of the responsibility. The divine responsibility is much more easily achieved. The human responsibility is something which is really the key factor to the question of whether humanity will actually live out its aspiration or not. And so that transition has to be embodied. The embodiment implies not merely the divine coming to the earth, but also the human coming to the divine. The embodiment is, that's why the embodiment is veiled. The embodiment is not like the embodiment of someone or some beings who come fully possessed of their divinity, but who in some sense constantly explore and come to the knowledge of their divinity as human beings. This is the reason why the humanity of Sri Aurobindo and the mother is as important to us and more important to us to recognize as human beings aspiring and moving towards that goal, to take up as our responsibility.
Debashish, that paragraph too also reminded, I don't know, somehow I kept thinking of the first line of Savitri in that.
Yes, of course, not only the first line of Savitri, which you're very, very right, the very first line of Savitri is very powerfully present in that, it was the hour before the gods awake. Very, very beautifully you've drawn our attention to that. But I'd say the whole of Savitri, its very theme, the occult meaning of Savitri is contained right there. So from a metaphysical point of view, we can talk about it because we can extrapolate from what Sri Aurobindo is saying and talk about embodiments of the divine in this hour of God. But from a existential and human point of view, it is also important to recognize the embodiment of the human spirit moving towards divinity in this hour of God. I think that is the aspect that is really key to our recognition of this hour and what it is that we need to do or learn from those very embodiments. See, so in a sense, whatever has been achieved in the background, but to worship it as an act of divinity hardly helps us. What helps us is to walk in the footsteps of that divinity that became human, and that beckons us to enter into its own law.
Devashish.
yeah, Vince.
It's kind of, from the last part of what you said, I was thinking, just made me think of Bhakti Yoga is just a type of yoga. I mean, it has its... limitations. If it doesn't include, you know, the knowledge part.
Yeah, no doubt. That's partly why the integral yoga must include the entire being.
Yes.
But also, if you're talking about bhakti yoga, the key to the bhakti yoga is the absolute and integral surrender of the being. And that is the power, that is the central power of the yoga. So I would say, in a sense, it is the key, but we must be able to extract from that key what is its, you know, truth, you know. Within, that is the part that's lost out. The integral surrender is something that must occupy every part of the Sri Aurobindo will make clear. In this very chapter itself, he also makes clear. That is every stand of the nature that must cede its law to the law of supermind. So this integrality, if this integrality is not allowed, if there is a certain part of the being that choose to remain what they are and bypass their law in terms of some kind of looking up, then there is no possibility of this transition. But the transition relies on the fact that human embodiments have taken up already the law of divinity, and it is possible for humanity at this point to surrender to that.
I still haven't resolved it in myself that this, in terms of bhakti yoga, a surrendering. Mother has written so much about surrendering and letting yourself be carried and giving yourself up. Somehow, I don't get where the intellectual understanding of the yoga comes in that way. Does she think it's, she's saying that it will just don't worry about it or just work itself out? Is it that she was talking to a certain group of people when she made those sayings? I just don't know.
Vince, actually, yeah. See, Vince, when we talk about surrender, we have to think about surrender in an integral sense.
Yes.
So, as far as knowledge is concerned, you're talking about understanding and vision, sight. And participation in being, these are aspects of knowledge. But even these aspects of knowledge can only come when the present state of ignorance of the human mind can surrender itself to a higher law. So surrender applies not merely to some kind of a unthinking and passive process, but in really being able to make the aspiration enter into every part of the being. The mind must actively make it surrender. You cannot say the mind does not exist, and so it doesn't need to make any surrender. It's only when we have the fullness of a inquiring mind that we can make the surrender of that mind to that which can inform it. So too with the heart, so too with the will, so too with all the various difficulties of the nature, so too with the body. So surrender applies in a different way to every part of the being. And what the mother is talking about is this integral surrender, some kind of just flowing in the current and thinking that one has surrendered is not what she's talking about.
Well, thank you. That helps me. There seems to be I guess it's just my experiences at the ashram. There just seems to be maybe I have it wrong, of course, but there just seems to be a group of people that think that, I don't know, if you can just surrender passively, everything is be done. And I can see it going now as they kind of missed some of the points of it, missed some of the integrality of it all that way.
See, also, Vince, you see, the problem is that the experience of anything that's said is something that is within the consciousness of the being who says it. What is understood by anything that is said, particularly in terms of yoga, can only be understood in consciousness. Whatever some people may say or not say means nothing. That is something which one has to arrive at, that you have to individually experience it and not rely on anybody else's evidence of what they think it is. It's only when that sort of distancing can take place that the full meaning of the integral yoga can begin emerging. Before that, you see, when we were talking about Nietzsche, one of the major sort of contributions of people like Nietzsche is to point to the fact that it is only when we learn how to extricate our individual consciousness from the herd mentality that it is at all possible for this reversal of consciousness to take place. No one person or group's evidence of what it means to do the integral yoga should have any effect on us. What Sri Aurobindo and the mother have said have a complexity beyond the understanding of any human being at this point of time. And therefore, we have to, in a kind of a completely individual way, aspire to receive that which has never been received. This is an unprecedented kind of yoga. And the evidence of people, groups, herds, etc., should be kept behind us as far as possible.
So
what you're saying about the consciousness experiencing it being the only source of truth, so in a way it makes the whole path very lonely, isn't it?
No, I wouldn't say it makes it lonely. It seems to make it lonely, and in fact that is how a whole branch of what are known as the existentialists have talked about it as being a very lonely path. But I wouldn't say it is lonely, because it in fact enlarges the consciousness into cosmicity. It is lonely in the sense of no longer falling into the sort of consciousness of the herd or the group or what one might call, you know, the mass. But it is certainly not lonely in the sense that it enlarges the consciousness into the understanding of the truth of things in a cosmic way. Certainly, if you want to look at it from that point of view, Sri Aurobindo and the mother were the loneliest people in this world. How many people could understand them?
Sure.
Of the yoga, and that growth is something which actually encompasses the whole cosmos. There isn't the quality of that experience is not one of loneliness. It is one of fullness. Purnata.
Maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but studying the yoga or doing yoga is certainly like separated me from other people in many cases. But I've also found that, you know, it's just, it leads to such nice feelings when I meditate and have experiences of the heart and all. It isn't lonely, but it is isolating.
I also feel that it is probably that is one of the greatest challenges of yoga, that you do start with that loneliness, because as I feel that just like as you say, reversal of consciousness, like from external to internal, this shift that all of a sudden you start feeling that lack of support of the external situation, and it has to be replaced by the internal support. This relationship that we have from our childhood is with the external world in different ways, that sort of starts getting turned into the inner direction. And that loneliness is one of the challenges. I mean, at least it is my experience as well.
Yes, exactly. No doubt. But that is exactly the experience of that transition and replacement, as you call it. But it is a different kind of fullness that replaces, that is, so-called fullness.
And basically, there is probably a lifetime and multiple lifetimes that it takes to sort of replace. So that process of replacement is not harder. Basically, it's like the power, developing the power to be constantly at that state is something a challenge.
Yes, that's true. Now, that's exactly where what Sri Aurobindo is going to point out here, is that the development of the power of inner consciousness may start off individually when first it enters into a greater harmony with the cosmic law without identifying with it. Still, there is a different distinction between the individual and the cosmic. But still, one comes into closer union with it. One recognizes that there is a cosmic being that in some sense is all-pervading and all-encompassing, and that one is in communion with it. That itself, that communion, is a tremendous source of strength, because it's a source of strength beyond one life. See, our lives are a grasping at visible things. That is the whole phenomenal basis of mortality. It actually breathes on this sense of insecurity of the disappearance of the visible. But the more we enter into this intuition of the eternity of ourselves, the more we recognize the fact that the phenomenal is just a passing show, and there is something eternal and permanent behind it, with which we are in communion. It's that communion that actually gives fullness, much greater fullness. Even a touch of that fullness makes one realize how inauthentic our normal sense of loneliness and not loneliness, etc. is. But it's only when one can come sufficiently into union with the cosmic consciousness, it is only when the psychic being, when the second of the three transformations takes place, that there is the full realization of being the cosmic being, the cosmic Purusha. Now, that is a very long transition. But nevertheless, and as you said, it may take several lifetimes in normal human cases, unless it is mediated by a higher Shakti that speeds it up. But nevertheless, I think that throughout, as we grow within in this transition, the sense of the divine also becomes more and more concrete. This is really the savior, because the psychic life makes us really much more in tune with the divine in all things, and sense of loneliness disappears completely. Two of the immediate effects of the emergence of the psychic being is the disappearance of the sense of loneliness and the disappearance of the sense of boredom.
I think that it reminds me of that film Matrix, that taking the blue pill or something, I don't remember which color it was, that once you take it, I mean, there's no way back. I mean, but at the same time, you have to take the pain of the journey.
Yes, no doubt. In fact, that is also one of the deciding factors that sense of no way back. That even if it were, as Sri Aurobindo says, even if I knew that I would complete new, very well beforehand, that I would fail, there is no way back.
Yeah, and thank you, Devashisa. That was useful. Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Keka, would you like to read? Keka, are you muted?
Sorry. It is the first condition of this change, right? That's the...
No.
No, it is conceivable indeed, right?
That's the one.
Yeah. It is conceivable, indeed, that without the distance, by a secret pressure from above, by a long evolution, our terrestrial nature might succeed in entering into a close contact with the higher, now superconscious planes, and a formation of subliminal overlying might take place. Behind the veil. As a result, a slow emergence of the consciousness proper to the entire place might awake on our surface. It is conceivable that in this way there might appear a race of mental beings thinking and acting not by the intellect or reasoning and reflecting intelligence and or not mainly by it, but by an intuitive mentality which would be the first step of an ascending chain. This might be followed by an over-mentalization which is carrying us to the borders beyond this life, beyond which lies the supermind or divine gnosis. But this process would inevitably be a long and toilsome endeavor of nature. There is a possibility too that what would be achieved might only be an imperfect superior mentalization. The new higher elements might strongly dominate the consciousness, but they would be still subjected to a modification of their action by the principle of the inferior mentality. There would be a greater expanded and illuminating knowledge, a cognition of a higher order, but it would still a mixture, subjecting it to the law of the ignorance, as mind undergoes limitation by the law of life and matter. For a real transformation, there must be a direct and unveiled event. There will be necessary too, as total submission and surrender of the lower consciousness. A cessation of its insistence, a willing it for its separate law of action to be completely annulled by transformation and lose all rights over our being. If these two conditions can be achieved even now by a conscious call and will, I somehow feel like I read this, I don't know. If these two conditions can be achieved Even now, by a conscious call and will in the spirit and a participation of our whole manifested and inner being, make change and elevation. The evolution, the transformation can take place by a comparatively swift conscious change. The supplemental consciousness force from above and the evolving consciousness force from behind the veil acting on the awakened center of the being would accomplish by their united power the momentous transition. There would be no further need of a slow revolution found in many millenniums for each step. The halting and difficult evolution operated by nature in the past in the unconscious creatures of the beginning of it.
Actually, indeed, the reason why you felt that you read it before is that this paragraph and the previous one were read last time, and we are revisiting the paragraphs. Because I wanted to emphasize this point that was not sufficiently your attention last time about the key element of the intervention that he's talking about here. And in this paragraph, he's in some sense completing the idea that he introduces in the previous paragraph. And he's contrasting the need of the hour with the evolutionary movements that have gone so far. He is saying that it's possible that just as in the past, there is a certain slow movement of aspiration from below, pressure from above, and the development of the powers of this higher consciousness in the occult and subliminal ranges to gradually arrive at various levels of consciousness. So to that kind of process is possible, but it would take a very long time because it would be beset at every moment by possibilities of error, by approximations, by modifications, by lower consciousness, and also by of a certain possibility of its being sidetracked. See, now the point he's making over here, though, there are a couple of things he's pointing out over here that are very important from our point of view, because one of them has to do with a perceived progression. That perceived progression, if it works out in the proper direction, is the gradual entry of the power of intuitive mentality in human action. That he is pointing out here from our present reliance on the rational process. A certain sector of mankind, of humanity, may develop that relies more directly on the power of intuition. And this might gradually move into a certain kind of a greater harmony with cosmic processes, leading to an over-mentalization. Now this idea in itself is something of great significance, because irrespective of the difficulties that he's pointing out, he has elsewhere and later in this very Life Divine pointed out that were the intervention to occur, this would be possibly the way in which that transition would take place. So if there is to be an evolution which is cosmic, that is mediated by a descent or intervention, we may expect to see gradual expressions or manifestations of the higher ranges of mind in ordinary humanity. That is one of the things that he has pointed out. But here he is saying that by the normal processes of nature, if this were to take place, it would be an extremely slow and difficult transition or progress. Partly because, as with everything else, the emergence of these higher powers would be subjected to the law consciousness in a phenomena. This is the this is what we can see all around us. The mother has pointed out that this is the real difficulty of the ignorance, which is that whatever enters it is immediately subjected to a leveling set of action and questioned at its base and brought down to the level of the lowest. Even the highest is defied and made uncertain to the degree of being at the same level of power as all the various low forces of this universe. So too, if intuitive mentality were to manifest, it would be treated as just a doubtful thing, and also its power would be at best uncertain, the lower it tried to enter into its into the movements of nature. Now, this difficulty can only be overcome if whatever intervenes is not just a pressure from above, not even a descent from some partial consciousness, but an intervention and descent from the higher sort of plane of knowledge itself, from the supermind. This is the key factor that he is bringing out over here. It also illuminates why Sri Aurobindo was not satisfied with any intermediate solution. As we know, in 1926, when the fullness of the second transformation took place in him with the Auromental manifestation, the mother also had prepared a precipitation of Auromind that would actually start manifesting as a cosmic Auromental consciousness. First among a certain number of individuals, but then spreading into the world out of that. But Sri Aurobindo was not inclined towards that process. He denied that process because of exactly what he's talking about over here. That in terms, it would not be complete, it would lend itself to a certain moderating influence by the ignorance that might make people in some case, in some sense, stuck. There would be a sense that we've reached a compromise which is sufficient to make us complacent. And Sri Aurobindo did not want that compromise. That compromise is not something that would allow us to move further. Hence, it's absolutely important for the fullness of the intervention to take place. If we talk about embodiments, even those embodiments are just possibilities. The work of the embodiments is ultimately this intervention that he's talking about. That intervention can only take place through the will of the divine. Now, the will of the divine has to be mobilized. That is exactly what the interventions, even at the embodiment level, are here to do. That was Sri Aurobindo's own work. Now, also in this particular paragraph, he is pointing to the human side of the equation, which is absolutely necessary. And it bears repetition. As he's saying over here, for a real transformation, there must be a direct and unveiled intervention from above. There would be necessary too a total submission and surrender of the lower consciousness, a cessation of its insistence. Now that phrase points to the negative side of the insistence, but the active side of the surrender, a will in it completely. Now this will be a change, and this will be an aspect of the end of our nature. Affections, passions, prayers, recognize only insufficient, surrender to this power through its operation. He as operate in every, not operate to that until manifestation has to be through a super. That's why he said, perceive evil. The third, and the partition of our whole being, the change and elevation, the transformation can take place by comparatively swift thing in Sri Aurobindo 4. This will be the part of the, but what the human needs to do is this, in which there has, in every part of our being, important. This is the key fact, in acting the surrender, it is own insufficiency. Yes, we are absolutely fulfilled. There has to be our own level with its own consciousness. See, as of what it means, can surrender. That's another very important word. Where is the deformation? I would be transformed saying this. So this is a pointer to the fact everything in us by its own consciousness is necessarily. That is the point he's making over here. And it is only when that happens that instead of that slow evolution, instead of the yoga of Prakriti, yoga of Purusha manifests itself.
Question. Two things. One is that can you elaborate on what does it exactly mean, precisely mean by being open? That word open, if you can start off with examples and all that, put some light into it. And another thing is that, you know, can you also put some light into a difficulty that is at least I am facing practically, that one is this, that not, you know, sometimes it feels, well, yeah, I have achieved some kind of state or something that kind of contentment or some kind of excuse of, you know, sort of being lazy or whatever. That is one problem. But another similar difficulty in parallel, okay, I'm not content by whatever the state is. But at the same time, it constantly complains about somebody else's state. Who is it all? Like, oh, this person, you know, doing this wrong. How could it be? Why is this person so insincere? And all the constant complaint. So that is also a parallel problem that I'm facing. So these two things, if you could address this.
Where did you come across that term open, you were saying? I'm just trying to see, you know, what the context of that open term was.
You yourself were saying while explaining this paragraph is that if you are our lower consciousness or other beings, like, you know, open to the higher.
So essentially, you know, openness is the awakening of aspiration. Openness means that there is something in us that recognizes that there is something lacking and that there is something that can fulfill that lack. Now, both these things must be there and they may come one after another. But nevertheless, both of them must be present. Awakening to the fact that something is lacking has entered into the consciousness of modern humanity. But awakening to the fact that there is something that can fulfill it has not entered into the general mainstream. Also, I have to go back and go. Awakening to the fact that something is lacking is also common to modern humanity. But I'd say that there are sections of modern humanity, particularly the intellectual elite of modern world, have awoken to this fact of the insufficiency of our tradition. But this has led to an absurdism because they have not been able to develop the faith in something that can fulfill it. See, awakening to the insufficiency of our condition is achievable by mental consciousness. Mind can bring us to that point, but it is only the psychic that can bring us to the awareness of something that can fulfill it. So openness means that there has to enter into every strand of our nature these two kinds of movements. One is the sense of its insufficiency. the sense that it needs something more to fulfill it. And also the second part is the sense that there is something that can fulfill it. That's the faith. The faith in a divine perfection. So openness I define in those ways. Now, the other part that you were talking about with regard to the problem of finding fault with others in terms of the problem of insufficiency. Now, problem of that's a very good point you made, that indeed that is one of the things that stands in the way of the full recognition of insufficiency. The insufficiency is actually a contact, at least a contact, if not an identification, with something in the cosmic consciousness. Cosmic consciousness has divine elements in it. See, this is what, if we talk about Savitri, this is what relates to the triple soul forces. The triple soul forces are divine Shakti elements in the cosmic nature that are aware of what they are here to do, but are also aware of the cosmic ignorance, which makes it impossible for them to achieve what they want to do. They know that it is not possible for them. They are always saying that they are waiting for something greater to be born. Now, that sense ultimately comes only when consciousness develops to a certain degree and comes into some kind with some force of that nature. So that's why it's important for individual consciousness to deepen itself in every part of its nature and come into contact with some aspect of that cosmic consciousness, which recognizes that it is a cosmic problem, not your problem, not the problem of somebody's fault, etc., but that this is a cosmic insufficiency that causes these problems to occur. Once there is a degree of settlement in that perception, then there is a greater sense of acceptance, but also a much greater sense of aspiration and surrender to a higher power. That higher power can only change not only one's own consciousness to bear the cosmic ignorance, but also transform the cosmic ignorance that is around one.
That's very helpful. Actually, I sort of take it in my language that what you are saying is that you take yourself as an individual aspirant, but you take all others as a face of the cosmic being. It's like whatever is coming from anybody else, you don't take it as an individual thing. You are basically face to face with the cosmic being, which is expressing through its agents, sort of.
Exactly. And so there is a greater recognition of that insufficiency, not as individualized instances, but as a problem of nature. This problem of nature has to become concrete. We have to recognize it as a concrete problem of universal nature, which exists. It cannot be overcome through instances. It can only be overcome if there is a fulfillment of that which is insufficient. If this perception grows, in whatever element it grows, it brings us closer to this openness. And it also increases that aspiration for the power which can fulfill to come into our lives and also come into the cosmos.
There is also like then you are face to face with the fact that it is something in you which is opposing to it. So basically it's like a conversation. Because the cosmic self is, the being is also including me. As soon as you are seeing that it's a cosmic nature, you all logically know that I'm part of it.
Exactly. So, absolutely. Yes. Exactly.
Because, sometimes I felt like that, thinking that well, I'm being judgmental, or why should I have anything to do with somebody else's problem, that is that person's problem. But it's very difficult to push it totally away from the mind. But this thinking of this as a face of the cosmic being is probably a very nice tool or process.
Yeah, you see, then it's all a process of growth of consciousness, and what you're saying is very natural, because indeed that's how we are constituted. We are constituted in a way in which the individual is separated from other beings, and our, again, that ignorance makes us think that problems can be set right if we can engineer our circumstances, and if everybody else around us, you know, is the way we want them to be. But nature contests that and constantly puts us in the face. Actually, there's a wonderful place where a mother talks about the fact that those who divine selects are never put at rest. Always they are put in conditions where they are not allowed to feel, you know, that things are at rest. Because only in that particular kind of condition, the insufficiency of cosmic nature can come home to us. Otherwise, it's easy for an individual to feel satisfied because conditions are okay around them. And also many yogis, they create these kind of placid circumstances so that they can meditate and enter into inner worlds. But it doesn't change anything in terms of this transformative power. So here, this kind of situation ultimately is something that eggs us on and is very helpful in the growth of consciousness. Through the rubbing of the consciousness, we come closer and closer to recognizing the fact that this is a universal problem, that this problem belongs to nature ultimately, and our aspiration unites and individualizes the aspiration in nature much more than even nature can do itself. And through that, and with the it can be changed, some new powers come into existence. It is only when more and more human beings can do that, that what Sri Aurobindo is talking about can achieve itself with relative quickness, as he says.
Actually, just while you were speaking, one more thing just came that, you know, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, that it means that, I mean, really respond to some problem is also a problem, which is basically giving the reality to that problem, right? So, and at the same time, we pretend mentally that, oh, the problem does not exist, or I'm seeing it wrong, I have a wrong spec to which I'm looking. Even though that also doesn't work, because it's ultimately... it doesn't have the power. So basically, to push it, I mean, not give it a reality, you have to grow in power over it in order to make it unreal. So that point for that power, you need that, again, aspiration and prayer and all that stuff.
Yeah, of course. And actually what you point out also is that there is a practical problem involved in this. And that's also really a problem of the growth of consciousness. The mind often catches or intuits certain things before the fullness of one's nature can actually put it into practice. Firstly, there is a practical problem in the sense that one has to deal with one's life in the best way that one can. And so in doing that, there are certain types of actions that one must take with regard to beings and things around one. So that is one aspect of the thing. The other aspect has to do with interpreting one's reality. So that is where the judgment comes in. On the one hand, one may see that there is insufficiency around one and try to compensate for it through various kinds of practical actions, including maybe being harsh with somebody or trying to, you know, sort of put them right or trying to set something in its right place. That is a practical action. But on the other hand, as far as interpretation of that reality goes, there has to develop a certain perception that this is a universal problem. Then, along with whatever practical skill is involved, the inner power of aspiration also becomes active, because then there is a certain another yogic action to play.
So Devashishta, that is the same process we follow for, we can follow for ourselves as well, right?
Yeah. How do you mean? I mean, it is a process we follow for ourselves.
I mean, as far as the interpretation of our actions are the corrections we make to ourselves.
Yes. Yes, very true. Very true. Even there, the same kind of development of consciousness must take place. It is a sign of the development of consciousness, because you see, some of these things don't happen. The mind might intuit it, but they don't happen in the fullness of consciousness until the aspiration emerges. Yet, the mind can be a great helper in this process. If the mind intuits something which is an insufficiency in cosmic nature and applies that interpretation, whether to oneself or to others, that is the meditation. The holding of a certain interpretation in the mind is a kind of meditation. One holds a certain view, and that view enters into the consciousness and becomes real. So once it becomes real, one suddenly recognizes the fact that this is my general mood. There is a certain kind of overtone of consciousness by which I experience things. And that overtone has included this interpretation. That is a key point at which one may say that the consciousness has grown to that degree. Otherwise, one can say it to oneself. You see, just like what Keka was saying, that we can recognize these things sporadically. At a certain point in time, I can think it. And having it, I can actually, say that it's an abstract idea that, is helpful in some sense. But how real is it? That can only be through an experience in consciousness. That sporadic idea has to settle into a perception. That is what that growth of consciousness is all about.
Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Vince, would you like to read?
Can you hear me okay?
Now we can, yes.
Oh, okay, great. I thought I did something wrong. Okay. It is a first condition of this change that the mental man would know. Sorry. It is a first condition of this change that the mental man we now are should become inwardly aware and in possession of his own deeper law of being and its processes. He must become the psychic and inner mental being, master of his energies, no longer a slave of the movements of the lower property, in control of it, seated securely in a free harmony with a higher law of nature. An increasing control of an individual over his own action of nature, a more and more conscious participation in the action of universal nature, is a marked character. It is indeed a logical consequence of the evolutionary principle and process. All action, all mental, vital, physical activities in the world are the operation of a universal energy, a consciousness force, which is the power of the cosmic spirit, working out the cosmic and individual truth of things. But since this creative consciousness assumes in matter a mask of inconscience and puts on a surface appearance of a blind universal force, executing a plan or organization of things without seeming to know what it is doing, the first result is akin to this appearance. It is the phenomenon of an inconscient physical individualization, a creation not of beings, but of objects. These are formed existences with their own qualities, properties, power of being, character of being. But nature's plan in them, in organization of them, have to be worked out mechanically without any beginning or participation, initiation or conscious awareness in the individual object, which emerges as the first dumb result in inanimate field of her action in creation. In animal life, the force begins to become slowly conscious on the surface and puts forth the form, no longer of an object, but of an individual being. But this imperfectly conscious individual, although it participates, senses, feels, it only works what the force does in it, without any clear intelligence or observation of what is being done. It seems to have no other choice or will than that which is imposed on it by its formed nature. In human mind, there is the first appearance of an observing intelligence that regards what is being done, and of a will and choice that have become conscious. But the consciousness is still limited and superficial. The knowledge also is limited and imperfect. It is a partial intelligence, a half having an empirical and great part, or, if rational, then rational, by constructions, theories, formulas. There is not as yet a luminous seeing which knows things by a direct grasp and arranges them with a spontaneous precision according to the seeing, according to the scheme of their inherent truth. Although there is a certain element of instinct and intuition and insight which has some beginning of this power, the normal character of human intelligence is an inquiring reason, a reflective thought, which observes, supposes, infers, concludes, arrives by labor at a constructed truth, a constructed scheme of knowledge, a deliberately arranged action of its own making. Or rather, this is what it drives to be and partly is. For its knowledge and will are constantly invaded, darkened, or frustrated by forces of the being which are half-blind instruments of the mechanism of nature.
So, again, in this wonderful paragraph, it's one of, you know, this most beautiful paragraph, Sri Aurobindo outlines his scheme of evolution as the way by which, on the one hand, Purusha emerges imperfectly and individualizes itself gradually from being to being, from a completely objective condition to a more and more subjective condition. This pertains to the whole basis of our evolutionary universe as one in which the sacrifice of Purusha has taken place in two forms. One is
the cosmic disappearance of consciousness, which is fully conscious, has become inconscient. And the other is the fragmentation of unity into multiplicity. So that when the unconsciousness emerges in the form of nascent consciousness, it enters into a new the problem of multiple individualities. So, Urusha, in its fragmentation, interposes a new kind of manifestation of its own being, a problem, a challenge of many beings. This is the reason why Kapila was to point in the original Sankhya to the existence of many Purushas rather than one Purusha. So, Kapila, there is one Prakriti but many Purushas. Because in its emergence of subjectivity, there is a multiple subjectivity. There are separate subjectivities. So, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out how this impression also is ultimately an artifact of Prakriti, not really an emergence of Purusha. Purusha is the ultimate perception of the one in the many. That fullness to which individual consciousness grows is a universalization in which it sees itself as an individual operation of the one being. Now, this process is hardly complete, either in terms of Prakriti or in terms of Purusha. That is what comes, Sri Aurobindo brings out so beautifully in this paragraph. In terms of Prakriti, there has been a gradual development of the powers of active consciousness from a complete, what he calls somnambulist world, a kind of sleeping mechanical action of the material universe, to instinctive action, will, various operations of the life force, and then operations of intelligence. As he points out here, there is a gradation of the operations of intelligence occurring at the human level. At the lower level, there is the empirical mind, which rests on its conclusions on the external senses and on making certain kinds of statistical inferences based on these external senses. Then there is the rational mind, which can operate either on the empirical data to give form to it, or which can operate on its own, whether as a philosopher or as a mathematician, to construct the schemata of universal reality. Now, there too he points to the fact that it's beautifully brought out what this entire modern philosophical movement called constructivism, where we actually see that all that we all about ourselves, or try to mold ourselves into, or mold our societies into, are constructions of the mind that in some sense are relative. There may be other constructions as well. So that itself points to even movements such as constructivism in the field of philosophy, points to the emergence of this kind of a sense of insufficiency of mind. That we no longer are so sure or so confident about our mental powers. But he points to the fact that this is in fact that transition where we can intuit the existence of an operation mind that sees, that catches the true things, the shape of things and their truth. And that indeed is the fulfillment of a higher Prakriti, not of a Purusha, but of a higher Prakriti that still waits its hour. On the other hand, there is the growth of the power of individuality as conscious being. In objects not present at all, in animals only seemingly present, working as it were by some kind of universal laws of life in individual forms, in the human being emerging, but there too ruled by mass phenomena. That's again where there is a tremendous value to what people like Nietzsche are saying, in the need for the emergence from the herd.
in the need for the development of the discovery of something which is purely individual, which is not constrained by universal laws of nature, something which is free from nature. Now, that something which is free from nature is the journey of the Purusha that ultimately leads us to this long journey called the triple transformation. But nevertheless, that emergence belongs to the evolution of Purusha, just as the emergence of the powers of Prakriti belongs to the evolution of Prakriti. Sri Aurobindo begins this paragraph by pointing to what must happen if that emergence is to take place. And he talks in terms, again, in general terms, of those two kinds of transitions that prelude this entire journey. First is the development of the yogic consciousness. And the second is the development of the psychic consciousness. Development of the yogic consciousness is the ability of the individual being to have power over Prakriti. To what extent can we perceive the forces of nature? To what degree do we know the territory of our inner being? To what extent can we relate these powers of the inner being to the cosmic nature? These become the problems of the development of the yogic consciousness. Along with it comes the ability to go deep within and find that which has the intuition of the divine, that which knows the perfection that is yet to come and can aspire for it and surrender to it. That is the idea of the psychic being and its emergence. To the extent that these things happen, that there is a individual perception of the inner being, that there is a communion between the individual and the universal, what we were discussing just now, that the individual has to recognize more and more the insufficiencies of nature as universal problems. Then it comes into communion with the cosmic being. And at the same time, there has to emerge the sense of the perfection of the divine and the surrender to the perfection of the divine. That brings in faith, aspiration, faith and surrender that belong to the psychic being. These must take place together if that transition or evolution from the present condition of nature in the individual human is to have its fulfillment.
Saracha, would you like to read the next one? Yeah, there seems to be a lot of background noise. There is a lot of background disturbance, it looks like.
Yes.
This is evidently...
Hey, Sitara?
Yeah.
There's a lot of noise in the background.
Yes, actually my disc is singing quite a bit. Maybe that's because of that.
Okay, maybe in that case, somebody else can read, because it's like, it's more than just the disc spinning.
It is my disc. I can hear that noise. That's the reason I need it.
Okay.
Can you still hear it?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, somebody is speaking, maybe I can use my microphone and maybe the quality will be better.
Sure. Keka, would you like to read the next one?
Okay. This is evidently not the utmost of which consciousness is capable, not its last evolution and highest summit. A greater and more intimate intuition must be possible, which would enter into the heart of things, be in luminous identity with the movements of nature, assure to the being a clear control of his life, or at least a harmony with his universe. It is only a free and entire intuitive consciousness which would be able to see and to grasp things by direct contact and penetrating vision, or a spontaneous truth sense born of an underlying unity or identity and an action of nature according to the truth of nature. This would be a real participation by the individual in the working of the universal consciousness force. The individual Purusha would become the master of his own executive energy and at the same time a conscious partner, agent, instrument of the cosmic spirit in the working of the universal energy. The universal energy would work through him, but he also would work through her, and the harmony of the intuitive truth would make this double working a single action. A growing conscious participation of this higher and more intimate kind must be one accompaniment of the transition from our present state of being to a state of
So, this is a very beautiful small paragraph which completes the idea that Sri Aurobindo has presented in such a sweeping fashion in the previous paragraph. And this, in a way, also relates to the beginning of that paragraph where he's talking about what must emerge in terms of the transition into a new kind of supernature. What that supernature implies may be far away from us, but there has to intervene at the summits of nature, as he says in Savitri, two kind of working of nature itself. That is what one might call a movement into a yogic society. A yogic society would be one in which life would develop among people who are attuned to a greater power of Purusha and a greater power of Prakriti. That greater power of Prakriti is through an opening to the higher mind planes. This is what he's talking about here. In this small paragraph, he's referring to the mind planes proper to the consciousness of the cosmic ranges, perhaps up to the intuitive mind. Higher mind, illumined mind, intuitive mind, if they become active in the human mind, if human mentality bears more and more in its inner reality, the impress of these higher mind planes, a new perception will develop in us. A perception of the occult truth of things, we will be able to act in a way full of greater certitude, in a more direct way of truth. Now, of course, it will not be an inevitable and absolute truth as mind or supermind, but it would certainly be a much greater power of truth than whatever humanity utilizes at present in its relativity of ignorance. So that would be the power that would be mobilized in Prakriti. While in Purusha, there would be a greater sense of the mastery of being. There would be a knowledge of the forces of the individual Prakriti, and at the same time a growth in the sense of the cosmic. That is the thing that he's talking about here. And these higher mind planes make us enter into a greater and greater power of the cosmic. What is really interesting is, we think of the mind as something which is separated from the body. And it is true that even at overmind, mental consciousness cannot have full understanding of vital or physical consciousness. There is always going to be a certain residue of incompatibility or sort of lack of knowledge between these forms of consciousness. But the higher we go, the more universally active these powers of mentality become, even in vitality and physicality. Intuitive mind does not act only in mind. Intuitive mind becomes intuition in the vital and intuition in the physical as well. It has a greater transformative effect on the lower modalities of consciousness. So this kind of cosmic consciousness entering into our everyday lives would change the entire modality of our living. Purusha would become much more aware of cosmic nature and of the problems of cosmic nature, would see all individual problems as problems of cosmic nature. It would also have control, at least in terms of denying, you see, the Sakshi control. And at the same time, it would be a participant, if not Ishvara, it would be a participant in the movements of cosmic Purusha. This is a transition. It is not yet the fullness of cosmic Purusha that he's talking about. But he's talking about a transition in which individual Purusha is in communion with cosmic Purusha, is a partner, is a channel, an instrument of cosmic Prakriti. So this is a condition which gradually must be embodied by human beings. It is an achievable end. And I think this paragraph, though small, is a very important one for students of yoga, for those people who want to practice the integral yoga. This paragraph is a very key paragraph of what it is to be aimed at in terms of achievement of consciousness.
One question is that, because the mind, particularly since sometimes takes quite a living part in this kind of process, that mind has a tendency to put a goal and then work towards it. And as if it can see the goal, sort of thing. So there, it has this kind of extreme kind of approach, either taking all the things that are seen around as wrong and putting the will towards something else to be seen, taking all the things as right and seeing my own vision as wrong and, working towards correcting the vision or correcting the perception. So I think probably this kind of extremist approach itself is wrong. So it's some kind of perception of harmony that we need to work towards without thinking after the harmony how it would look like, right? So could you shed a little light of this process, how to rectify this process of this extremist approach of the mind?
Yeah, so yes, indeed, that kind of a process where, as you point out, it's a very interesting fact that you know, human beings are actually beings of the future. That is one of the characteristics of human beings. And in fact, maybe that is one of the main characteristics of being a mental being, which is that we have a different sort of relationship with time than vital beings or of rudimentary mental beings, as in the animal kingdom. More full-fledged relationship with same time, that relationship is a frustrating relationship. We look towards the future, but we have no full grasp of the future. We have no real grasp of the future. So this ability to look towards the future is in some way has a truth to it. It's a great strength. The strength is lies in the fact that it allows us to aspire. It allows us to aspire for perfection. But at the same time, it comes with certain defects in the ignorance. And these are the kinds of defects that you're pointing out. And in a sense, it actually tries to set a certain projected goal and keep make the present condition look like it is completely wrong, or the reverse would be that I am completely wrong and everything else is right. I think here this is actually a problem of individual mentality and also arises from the separateness of the human being, a sense of separateness and incomplete arising of the individual consciousness as Purusha. Now, what can be done about this particular thing? Only thing I can think of is that there has to be a certain deferment of judgment regarding the present condition of things. Yoga begins with a certain understanding of the state that it is myself that I have to change in consciousness, not necessarily that anything else will change, or that there is a state of perfection or imperfection around me, but that there is a journey that I have to undergo. And while this journey is going on, there has to be things, you know, way in which we accept things as they are. This acceptance of condition and at the same time dealing with it to order it is a journey itself, because along with it comes exactly what Sri Aurobindo is saying, that is a growth in the scale of power of consciousness. We have to deal with our nature, our own and outside nature, as one cosmic nature. And at the same time, we have to recognize the fact that there can be a higher scale to the power of operation, and our growth in consciousness must yield that power. So that is where aspiration must apply to oneself as well as to one's environment, not from the viewpoint that I am imperfect or the environment is imperfect, but that we proceed from a condition of universal nature that is imperfect with an aspiration to perfect it. And that aspiration changes our consciousness and gives us greater power over the environment and over ourselves.
Devashishda?
Yes.
No, I was just going to suggest that we continue next time. But did somebody have a was somebody starting a question in the middle?
Yeah, this is Bindu. I had a question.
Go ahead.
On this paragraph. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
The question is that there were a few lines here, which I was wondering if you could elaborate further. And it's towards the end. The individual Purusha would become a conscious partner, agent, instrument of the cosmic spirit in the working of the universal energy. And then he goes on to say that the universal energy would work through him and that he would work through her, and the harmony of the intuitive truth would make this double working a single action. Now, I am interpreting universal energy as being prakriti, nature, arising from unconscious, the question in my mind is, nature seems to be working out evolution in its own inconscient way, not fully conscious. And when there is a more conscious Purusha, how can there be harmony, if that makes sense? And I could elaborate on this. I remember the mother in one of her conversations saying that for a long time nature didn't want to consent to this evolution of Purusha. Nature was like, what's the hurry? There's plenty of time. And then I think a few years later, she says, nature has consented to this action. Does this make sense? Could you elaborate on this? Could you explain this?
I see what you're saying over there. What I understand by this Bindu over here, what Sri Aurobindo is saying, she's not talking about Prakriti as the emerging evolution from below, but when he's talking about cosmic and universal consciousness force over here, he's talking about overmental Shakti.
Okay, okay, then that's clear.
Is the conscious, is the Shakti of the cosmic Purusha, that is of overmind. So here he's talking about not supermind as yet, but he's talking, as I said, he's talking about the powers of the higher mental planes and of the individual Purusha in its emergence at the level of Sahasrara. So you see, if just like Sri Aurobindo and the mother both say that their consciousness was situated above the mind, it is really at the beginning of that process is when the Purusha establishes itself in the Sahasrara. Normally, this is considered to be the condition or avastha of Sushupti. But this condition can be part of Jagrat. And that is exactly the marking the transition into a new kind of nature. So, in that state, where Purusha is residing in Sahasrara, there is an openness to the action of the cosmic or the overmental Shakti, which is channeling through that particular center, but not in possession of it. So there is, as it were, both an openness to the cosmic Shakti and a passive, channeling of the cosmic Shakti, and at the same time, of flowing down of the cosmic Shakti. Those are the two movements he's talking about there. But this channeling is not in his Purusha is also involved, as he says, as a partner. That partnership is the individual Purusha in its transitory journey as it becomes more and more of a agent that comes into gradual union with the cosmic Purusha. It's interesting that this particular paragraph again, or this part of that paragraph, can be related to the Kalki of Agastya and Indra in the Rig Veda. That is again, in that particular Kalki, you find that Agastya is the human Purusha in its transitional journey, and Indra is the cosmic Purusha, overmental Purusha, with whom he is in relation. And that relation must be a relation of harmony and ultimately a relation of identity. And then it can proceed further and move into an identity, a relationship again, first of harmony and then of identity with the supramental Purusha. So this is the transition he's talking about here.
Okay, yeah. Thank you so much for elaborating on that. I was completely misreading it. Thinking universal energy meant to lower Prakriti.
Yeah, no, one could think like that, but you see the way in which he has developed the transition in terms of the evolution of consciousness at this point in this paragraph, he's pointing to the universal consciousness force
as the unveiled power of overmind in the cosmic mind plane.
Thank you.
Shall we stop for today and continue next week?
Sure.
So yeah, let's end with a brief meditation there.
Sure.